And we believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I'm one of them too. I must have this thing. I'm going to introduce the introducer. Fred One, please come forward. Fred Two is on his way. My name is Fred, and I'm not caught. And the only reason they asked me is because I have a tie on. But it's a pleasure to introduce Fred. We've had a lot of conversations. As most of y'all know, this is the first time he's told the story in 20 years. Apparently, finally, it's not a big deal of telling the story. So it would be interesting tonight. I suggested to him that he not talk about his cool car. So he comes in carrying this up.
Yeah.
Subtle as a brick wall. I've enjoyed getting to know Fred. He started coming here about a year and a half ago at Corey's suggestion, thank goodness. And we kind of snuck up on a pretty good friendship. I'm not his sponsor. That's Ted's fault. We've shared a lot of laughs together and shared a lot of tears together. And he's a fellow that wherever he goes, he established himself as a leader. And I'm anxious to hear what he comes up with, even though he isn't.
My name's Fred Schreer, and I'm an alcoholic.
Well, it's almost over. 45 minutes to go. I heard a good line from a friend. As you can imagine, never having told my story, I got lots of good advice. One was that 15 minutes is as good as 40, which I like that the best, personally. The other one was to take some notes, put them down, have some bullet points so that you can not get lost in what you have to say. That was also some really good advice that I didn't pay attention to, which would have been a good idea. I always greatly enjoyed, when I first got sober, hearing people, speaker meetings. It meant a lot to me, and it was always helpful. And it's really been a very challenging experience not to have told my story in 20 years. Whenever it comes up, I just walk away, talk to somebody else, say hello to someone else, and so on. But to give you a little background, I was born in a little town called Hammond, Indiana, in 1953 to an Irish mother and a German father, which is the perfect recipe for having a lot of fun the rest of your life if you haven't had that chance. Sometime in around 7 to 9 years old, my mother committed suicide. And I like to think of my childhood as being a warm, fuzzy, wonderful opportunity. And with the exception of that experience, I think a lot of my childhood was pretty good. I learned to compartmentalize, as someone has told me that we do when we have horrible things that have happened to us. But I was primarily, back at that time, best of my recollection, madder than hell at God. Because I wasn't mad at my mother for what she did. I was just mad at God. And that kind of set a tone for a long period of my life, I think. I always got a kick out of, when I was a kid, being the funniest guy in the room, being the class clown and whatnot. And being 6'7" at 12 years old is pretty good to be a class clown at that height. But childhood, my grandparents brought us up, very strict German household. I was used to being rewarded for things well done, all the way down to cutting grass. My God, I was the best grass cutter on the planet. Because my father would, back then you didn't have powered instruments to cut grass. It was not back when Fred was born, they had horse and buggy. But it has a lot, we just didn't have power instruments. But I was very precise at how I'd cross-cut grass. Matter of fact, I was precise at everything. I was a precise basketball player, water skier. Anything I can do to get adulation for my skills and talent, I invested myself in. because for whatever I did, I was equally rewarded. And that's just how it was. So to say I'm a little intense is probably an understatement. But it served me growing up to be that way. I didn't drink when I was younger. Didn't even think about drinking. My family did most of that for us. My grandfather, when my grandmother would tell him to have breakfast, he'd go get an egg and open a bottleneck Schlitz bottle and put the egg in his beer, and he had breakfast. So I was like, well, okay, that's how it's supposed to be. But I didn't imbibe in any of that stuff. I was mostly a gopher as a child, getting my father his beer and everything we did when he wasn't working. But again, I think, unlike a lot of people I've heard over the years, I didn't have, a lot of traumatic other things that happened to me at that age. I'm glad I lived at a time where when somebody committed suicide, it wasn't, oh, his mother killed herself. Over the years, that's become less and less of a problem, but it's always a stigma, I guess, that you live with. But as I grew older, I got very active in the church. And one of the things that was very frustrating for me is I had memories of blood-spattered bathrooms and stuff, but I couldn't tie it into, when I was younger. And so a lot of my memories before 12 are kind of rusty. I don't remember a hell of a lot. But I remember flunking catechism in the Lutheran church, which was not big in the household. We were always taught to be the best in the class, and so when I flunked catechism, my parents kind of scratched their heads and said, "What?" I said, "Well, wasn't that good? Wasn't that entertaining?" But I also remember the pastor of our church who had presided over my mother's funeral telling me at that time that your mother went to hell because that's the way it was. And that's what I was taught. And so I guess, in my own weird way, I was trying to somehow justify growing up with, well, the church I go to teaches that your mother went to hell because she was sick. That's like saying that somebody who has cancer, that dies from cancer, went to hell because they had cancer, and we don't like cancer. So that was to say that was a little overwhelming, that stuck with me for a long time. That while I was very active in church as a young man, underneath it all, there was this undertow of total sadness and frustration, because the one thing I was taught to rely on in my life, which was a higher power, somewhere in the middle of that, believe in the higher power, but wink, wink, don't believe in that. So about the time I got flunked catechism and moved on with that, I actually passed the following year, which was good news in the family, because my great-grandfather was also a Lutheran minister and taught school in Hammond. There was a Lutheran school for boys in Hammond back then. But into high school, in my family, it was very important that you did well in all things, as I said, very driven. And it was very important to my father that I play basketball in the NBA. And I think as a result of his desire for that, I worked really hard at being really good, but not trying too hard. I had the attitude, if you will. There was a pervasive, attitude that I kind of had. And so when I went off to college, that was the main thing. Don't worry about your grades. Just, become a great basketball player. So I went off to Georgia, and I'll be sober by 8:30 in case anybody's concerned about that. Going to have to hurry it up there just a little bit. But I went to the University of Georgia because all my father's friends, who were all kind of corporate giants, said the future in this country is in the South. And living in the region of Indiana, which was the steel mill area, they strongly suggested I get the hell out of the region. And that was one of the, listening to what people said, I did exactly what they said. That and the fact that the University of Georgia was the only person with my SAT scores that would accept me. So that played a significant role. I had a real high grade point average, but let's just say that my SAT scores were kind of high. And my introduction, and I still hadn't had anything to drink yet, I walked into my dorm room at Russell Hall, and a guy that looked a lot like the Allman Brothers Band sat down the bed across from me, dropped trowel, and lit himself on fire. And I remember, you know, the little boy from Hammond who went to the Lutheran school that was really quite a good student. This was my introduction to the University of Georgia. So I guess I needed to drink or something. But that was one of the... I was trying to pick up something funny in case... Because the story, to me, is not very funny, actually. But I met another guy not long after that from Savannah who turned out to be my roommate after that guy. I don't think AA was in his future either, but... we got together one night, and we decided, you know, he'd never drank before, and I'd never drank before, and while I had a lot of experience watching people drink, I had no personal experience. So we went out, and I've heard this from other people, we went out and bought two bottles of Boone's Farm Apple Wine. For each other, you know, two for me, two for him. And because I didn't have a taste for alcohol at the time, we got a stopwatch, and to see how fast we could chug it, because it wasn't real good. You know, I grew into much better brown whiskey, as Paul would say later. But I got, you know, after 4 minutes, we were looking at each other and go, "What's this about?" And I'm like, "I don't know. What do you think it's about?" So we got the second bottle and saw how fast, in like 30 seconds, it was down. I woke up the next day in a tub of ice in the bathroom. And that's about all I remember from my first excursion into drinking. I learned from that experience, though, one very important thing, is that if you have yucky feelings, you can use booze to feel better. And I set off from that experience to learn how to properly drink, you know, better stuff. Until I got to the point where I was drinking primarily scotch on a pretty regular effort until my sophomore year in college, which I learned how to smoke pot. Corey was teaching me a little bit about that when we got together. But I missed my sophomore year. I don't remember what happened that year. But I do remember that I quit smoking pot because it was illegal. And in the family I grew up in, that would be, if I had gotten arrested for smoking pot, you know, I'd probably gone to hell. But if you get arrested for drinking, you know, you get a thataboy or something like that. So I thought I was pretty empowered at that point in my life. Hell, I quit drinking pot or smoking pot. I just, you know, stay drinking. And I met, at that point, one of the most important people to come in my life. In January 11th, 1975, I married probably the most beautiful girl I ever went out with. And I asked all the girls I went out with to marry me, but she said yes, so that worked out well. And about 2 weeks after we were married, well, let me back up. I'll still get it by 8:30. My family was, "Do you sure you want to get married right now? Don't you want to finish college first?" "F you. I'm getting married now Saturday if you'd like to come." You know, I was going to get married in the summer, but we moved that date up because I was also the one kid in the family that did whatever I wasn't supposed to do, really. But it was never real heathen. Anyway, 2 weeks after we got married, she was coming home from class, and she totaled her car in the side of the road. It had an open case of beer in there, which I was shocked with. I was like, "What the hell is she doing drinking beer coming back from school?" And then the next night, she backed in my next-door neighbor's car, who was a policeman for Athens Police Department, and wrecked his car, and she'd been drinking again. So I went from drinking and smoking pot to being Efren Zembelis Jr., which was the pursuit of keeping my wife from drinking person. And I had a lot of years over the next 17 years of not drinking at all through those years, except for holidays, I always get loaded. My experience always with alcohol is very simple. I drank till I got buzzed, and then I passed out, which in some experiences is not so bad until you learn something more. But I remember calling my stepmother back at that time and said, Jesus, I married an alcoholic. And I was devastated. But I said, you know, we got married in church in front of Christ, and, you know, I got to make this thing work. And so I proceeded over the next 17 years of destroying her sense of self because I was busy watching her drink all the time. And I remember how much fun it was when she would disappear and call me 3 days later saying that she was drunk in New Orleans and could she come home? And I'd call all these hospitals and all this kind of stuff. And I learned that you can do to people just like you do to yourself with alcohol, without alcohol. So I kind of learned it on both sides of the glass, so to speak. And the most important thing in my life, I can tell you unequivocally even tonight, was to stay married to that woman. That was the most important thing on my mind. In 1985, I suffered a water skiing injury. It hurt my lower back pretty severely. And consequently, over the next 5 years, struggled with real severe lower back pain. And along with scotch, I found that tranquilizers were an effective assisting product to numbing back pain. And at the end of that five-year stint, on December 9th, 1990, I ended up in Emory Hospital. I called my brother. I weighed 203 pounds. I weighed 260 tonight. I weighed 203 at that time. My butt was so skinny, I had to sit on pillows so I wouldn't be in pain when I got to the hospital. And I spent the first 2 weeks of being in the hospital calling my wife every 20 minutes to see if she was okay. I'm just going to back up a little bit so you can understand what that deal was about. About 3 years prior to going to the hospital myself, I had come home one night, and my wife was black and blue. And I was like, what the hell happened? You get hit by a train? And she couldn't talk. And so I rushed her to the hospital. And I said, geez, I don't know what's wrong with my wife. I got other stories about that, but this is the most salient one. And they told me 24 hours later they'd done a blood alcohol on her. And she turns out that she was OD'd on tranquilizers. Well, I figured out pretty quickly, she took tetracycline for acne, and she put the tetracycline in my tranquilizer jar and put my stuff in her jar. And I was actually okay on tetracycline. I didn't get any zits. I got no acne, and I wasn't anxious. So, but you know, it's the first time I really had to confront just how much this woman did not like me anymore. And after I was at Emory for about 2 weeks, I was working on my first step. They gave us a workbook, thank God, something I could understand. And I got in there after about 2 weeks, and I said, oh, my God, my wife hates me. And, of course, she never came to the hospital after I was in the hospital and whatnot. And so, I mean, most people would have figured out she probably wasn't real happy with me. And I ended up getting out of the hospital after about a month, and I went to a halfway house, which I had no idea what the hell a halfway house, and a little Christian boy from East Chicago, what's a halfway house? But I did whatever the doctors told me. And ever since then, I've done what people told me, believe it or not, is with regards to my alcoholism. Regards to other things, not so much. When I got out of the halfway house, I went home. My wife announced to me that she was going to leave. And all I'd really cared about was staying married. I didn't care about my job. I didn't care about my future. And, you know, when you hear in the program that you may lose what you most tightly hang on to, I hate that shit. I didn't want to hear that. You know, especially after she left me, I was like, well, this sucks. And about 2 years later, she married her ex-boss, and she called me up. She said, you got to divorce me now. I said, oh, okay. So I did. And she, hopefully she's still happily married to him today. But I will always give her credit for saving your own butt. You know, living with somebody who's constantly trying to guard your drinking while at the same time developing their own problems in that area is like living in a zoo. And so I thank the world of her tonight, and I pray that she's doing well with that regard. But that set me off on getting sober. Damn, right on time. Right on time. Well, I've had 20 years to think about this. So anyway. But I got a call later that week from the hospital. They were doing all these back appraisals because I was struggling with all this back pain for so long. And they said, well, we found something on your x-ray and, you know, blah, blah, blah. And I said, oh, good. They figured out what the problem was. It wasn't me after all. It wasn't me carrying my wife for 17 years. Nah, it was cancer. And I was devastated, to say the least. If I hadn't been introduced to the 12-step program 60 days prior to that, that probably would have pushed me over the edge. I mean, it just, I remember being like, just, you've got to be kidding me. I've been through all this crap. My wife left me, and now I got cancer, and I'm supposed to be happy I'm sober. Yeah, okay, you be happy about being sober. But you know what? I never lost sight of that. I never lost sight of the fact that being sober was more important than anything else in my life, because I was blessed, I think, in some ways, to realize that my behavior for the years prior to getting sober was horrible. I thought I was the world's greatest husband, the nicest guy, all this kind of crap. But I was a horrible, I had grown into this, you know, control freak, which I still have some issues with. But after having the cancer surgery, I remember I had nobody to take care of me when I got done, so my ex-wife at that time said, well, Fred, I'll come home and take care of you. 4.5 hours later, I said, I think I can take care of myself. Because she was proceeding to tell me about, you know, how horrible our marriage was and all this, and, you know, I was like, yeah. So I crawled to the bathroom for about 6 weeks because I couldn't walk, and I'd crawl back to bed. And to make a long story short with regard, you don't have to leave early just because of me. I was back on my feet, on crutches and so forth, and a year following that, I had reconstructive surgery. I was originally 7 foot tall, now I'm 6'7", so that apparently worked as well as we had hoped. But I never lost sight of my sobriety. I went to Triangle religiously for a long, long time as a result of that experience. And I went to a lot of other meetings all over Atlanta. But I kind of specialized in not going too many places because my theory was if somebody knows you and you screw up, they can tell you. If you don't know you, you can just BS them and keep on going. So one of the other things I think it's really served me well is to not go too many places all the time. Not to discourage people from visiting other meetings. I'm all for that. But my experience was, guess what? You get to know me whether you want to or not. The following year, I met a rather beautiful airline pilot with Delta, and I was madly in love. And I dated every woman in Atlanta, except for those sitting here tonight, before I got married again. But I thought I was going to get married to her. I mean, I decided. She's from Wisconsin. And they had it all. They went to a Catholic church and drank at the little pub right up the street. So that was a good idea. But I didn't drink. And once I realized that she was an alcoholic, I remember one day walked up the steps and she was carrying a couple of bottles of booze because her family was coming to visit. And she yelled up the steps, I'm not June. Don't treat me like I'm an alcoholic. And 2 years later, she went into rehab. I went into a severe depression because here I was back the same old show again. The difference was, is I knew the right thing to do was not to treat tranquilizers, and I went back in the hospital suffering from depression because the last thing I wanted to do is start taking, you know, drinking and drugging again. That just wasn't on my program. I'd rather sit in the hospital, make my own bed, and go doo-da-doo-da all day than go back to... Isn't that what you do in the hospital? You go do-da, do-da. That's about all I did, too, so do-da, do-da. But anyway, I got out of the hospital after that, and I went to a meeting at a place called the Night Owl Club. I don't know if it exists anymore, but I was very blessed. I've been sober 3 years, and there was a lady speaker that evening, and she said she'd been sober for 10 years, but the first 3 years of her sobriety were just hell. It was just absolutely miserable, but she'd stayed sober. But she finally went to a doctor and got on some antidepressants. And now she's still sober, but she was taking an antidepressant. And I was sitting back in the room like, that's what they told me to do. You know, you got some issues. You know, your mother killed herself. You might have inherited something there. And I'm like, ooh. But I felt like I got permission that night to take care of myself beyond my addiction. I meet a lot of people in AA that also suffer from depression and other things. You know, some people are tall, some people are short. And it's an affliction you can do nothing about. Right, Jenny? You're just not tall, and that's what it's going to be. But she is precious. Anyway, but I learned a lot, you know, in that experience. And I've suffered 3 major depressions in the last 20 years, aside from that depression. And moving right along to more exciting times, in 2003, on December 13th, I was diagnosed with congestive heart failure. You know, by then I've been sober quite a long time and whatnot. But again, I was absolutely crushed. If it's not clear to you yet, let me help make it clear to you. I need to both suffer from physical and emotional pain to make progress. I don't know how it worked for you, but I had to have them both. So, you know, while I don't necessarily like the way God operates all the time, I respect the way He operates today. And it was what I needed at the time. And now looking back to 2003, it was good that I suffered with congestive heart failure. I had 10% heart function. I went to the finest doctor in Atlanta. And he told me I need to have a heart transplant by the end of the summer, which was all real encouraging news. And I was devastated. Well, what I did is I went back. I've been going to meetings like once a week at Triangle. And over the 20 years or so, I've gone to meetings in Emory for 20 years. So I never stopped doing service work. But I wasn't doing much work on myself. So in 2003, I said, uh-oh. And I mean the biggest way. You know, I'm going to die. And I'm not ready to die. You know, 2 years prior to that, I'd met the most wonderful woman on the planet, which I brag about quite a bit, you know what I'm saying? Ted married above himself. I married above myself. But it was, I can't tell you what it's like. I mean, we just lost a dear friend this weekend in this clubhouse. And I talked to his wife tonight, and I could tell you what sorrow is. I mean, I just saw it recently in preparation for trying to be funny tonight. But I went back to my group at Triangle, and the Triangle Division is sitting mostly over here. Of course, Murray and Harry are also here. But anyway, I listened to a guy talk, share, represent, you know, something that I thought he'd understand me, a really good sponsor. And, of course, I waited at that time for a couple of years of listening to him until he was having some tough times to ask me my sponsor. And I did. I finally asked to be my sponsor, thank God. And I started actually making some progress in the program. And I tried not to be a needy sponsee. You know, I mean, I had, I don't know, 14 years when I asked Ted to be my sponsor. But he owned a business, you know. He was reasonably successful. He had a Corvette Z06. I had a Z06. Thank God he didn't have a Mercedes-Benz. No offense, Corey and Fred. But it was somebody that I knew would understand all the things I've lived through. And so I can say that after, you know, about 14 years, I started making some real progress on, you know, not only just being sober, but finding the one thing I could never find in life, which was peace. So in spite of the fact I had this health thing over my head, and my wife of 2 years found out she's married to a guy who might die in 6 months, which sounds like a pretty rough time, and believe me, it was a rough time. And I wasn't mature enough at the time to really feel for her as I should have felt for her. I was mostly just feeling but for myself. Yeah. Poor, poor, pitiful me. And then I found out later that the pastor, church, who's also a lady, was taking care of my wife. And I was thinking to myself, oh, church can work. There's something there that can happen, you know, that's a positive thing. So not too long after that, I started going back to the same church and whatnot. Like Paul says, you know, make peace with the church of your youth, except for a few things, okay? There's some, I'll be clear, there's some things I just never learned in church that were helpful here. I also don't discourage that from people after you've been sober for a while to pursue that in your higher power deal. But I give credit in this way at that time to make a huge change in my life. This guy, it's not what he said. He was a good talker. You know, I'm a good talker. You know, he's kind of full of crap. I'm kind of full of crap. But I watched what he did, and not so long ago, just to give you an example of the things that impressed me and how it affected me, is there was a guy that came to this meeting at NABA who had just been beat up, got a steel plate put in his jaw, and the guy I'm talking about took his coat off his back. It was a cold day, he gave him his coat. He didn't say, good luck. He gave him his coat because it was cold outside. And so that was the beginning in my sobriety of being sober, that I finally realized it doesn't make any difference what I say to you tonight. I've been freaked out for a month. I was hoping somebody else would take the slot and I wouldn't have to be here. I'd have paid you for it. Big bucks. I mean, in, you know, maybe triple digits. But I did. But I learned a very important lesson. You know, it's no longer is it good enough just to be being full of crap. But what it needed to be was being a genuine person about who I was, who I wanted to be, and what I've been through. It made me who I am, and so forth. And I finally started looking at myself. Well, you know what? Yeah, I've got a few things. I've had cancer. I've had heart failure. I've suffered with depression most of my life. But I've been wildly successful in other ways, beyond my imagination. You know, as I said, probably the most wonderful thing in my sobriety is after 10 years of being sober, to meet a woman that really did love me, and how wonderful that was. So, thank God she left. If the other lady had left, I'd be dead. You know, so it was all good in the final analysis. I didn't think anybody would respect me unless I say I've been married for 50 years, you know, that kind of thing. And the reason she married me is because I never said anything icky about my ex-wife. I was like, what? Aren't you supposed to bitch about your previous relationships? I said, I don't have anything nasty to say. She had her issues, I had my issues, you know, that kind of thing. But it was the demonstration, and I'll be forever grateful for that person in my life. And I continue to watch him, you know, go through life and life's challenges and so forth, trying to do the next best thing and always trying to put what the next right thing would be. And that's my goal now. I couldn't retire. My sponsor watched me struggle horribly with retirement. You know, when your heart goes to crap, you really can't work all the time, okay? You may want to. And I would like to stand up tonight for you so that you could see how handsomely tall I am. But it just feels better sitting on my butt because it doesn't take as much energy. But it turns out to be a beautiful thing because I found that by donating my time in AA and working with other people, that it's better than making money. I know it's scary to say. I know if you don't have a Porsche or something, you may not feel that way. But it's a wonderful thing to see people grow. And, you know, a lot of times I ask them to say something nice about me in public, but it never happens. No, I'm kidding about that part. But if you stay sober long enough, my experience is eventually you'll get it. And I'm not talking about just not drinking. I sit in meetings today. I go to a meeting every day, by the way. I did that for the first 4 years of my sobriety. I got away from it. But John told a good story when he shared his story about being away for about, 14 years. And that's not so dissimilar to what I fell into. That's why I've always felt close to John and when he shares. But it is so cool to finally reach a point in your life where I'm at peace. I'm not at peace tonight, okay? I'm sweating a little bit. But I did bring a sweat rag, so in case of... When I got married 11 years ago, I was sweating so bad I had a Canon towel. You can imagine her parents at that one. But if you can't drink and you can't take drugs, you might sweat a little bit. But I finally found a path. And Corey, as Fred had said, had suggested that I come to this meeting. And I did a little over a year and a half ago now. And I think one of the wonderful things about that is it reinforced all the wonderful things that were happening to me over the years at Triangle, too. And I still continue to go to Triangle. I primarily weekly come here. But I've learned I can't say anything that's going to save you tonight. There was a time in my life where I would have desperately wished I could. But to the people who are relatively new in the program, I sit in meetings going, please make it. Please make it. And every once in a while, ooh, good to see you. Every once in a while, it's good to see somebody make it. And sometimes people don't make it. And those are a matter of choice. I've learned over time that if you decide not to make this work, you have the power over that. And that's a choice. I'm also glad that I had made some other choices, both financially and otherwise in my life that ended up paying off in the long run. But the bottom line is there is nothing without a sense of peace in my life. My life only really came to being at peace in the last 4 or 5 years. And, not to overstate it or understate it, it has to do very much with people. I believe in a power today that's unquestionably taught me to be in service to others. Because the people that I hold in high esteem in here, that's what they do. Not this, but they do it. And I'm blessed tonight to see some people in the audience tonight that I've met in the hospital at different times in my service career, and they're still here. It's getting a little expensive. It's $500 a week to stay sober. And I just can't afford anymore, so you are on your own now if you're one of those people. One other thing. If you think having a cool car will cure you, I had cool cars when I was drinking. It didn't save my butt. Okay, so that's not going to happen. But I want to close with this one little thought because it's always the things that happen most recent are the most valuable. I've just been all kind of nervy. When I get that way, I don't call my sponsor. I just kind of lay low, But I have talked to some other people, but over the last several weeks, I've been praying for certain people. Now, you don't have to join the Baptist Church or the Catholic Church to make that effective. But the people I've been praying for, I don't always get what I want either. But Jenny had brain surgery about 2 weeks ago, and I'd mentioned in meetings, let's put in a good word for Jenny. Well, she's here tonight, and this morning, she put her hand on my chest, and she said, Fred, I've said my story twice, but all I can tell you, it's going to be okay when you're done. Like a TV for it'd be glory. But today... All humor aside, it meant something to me because I know today to listen. And that was from my higher power to me. Don't worry about it. You can do it in 15 minutes, right? But I didn't. It took more than 15 minutes. I was sober by 8:30. There is never going to be a greater time in your life if you will stay sober for a while. Does it take 21 years to tell your story? Hopefully not. But I today learned one other thing in the last 6 months to a year. I wish everyone well. I could have told some stories of meanness and redneckedness you know, in my past, that, you know, if it was an all-guys group, we would have shared some of that stuff. But that's not what I'm proud of today. I'm so very grateful that I do care about you. There's an old fart that comes to this meeting at 11 o'clock. I wish you well. Crap is worth coming over here just to hear that. Because Rachel's not here tonight, but she shared in the meeting today about, you know, people getting frustrated with you. We get mad at each other, okay? We don't always love each other. But is there anybody in here that you don't wish well? I never had that until AA. Thanks for letting me share. Thank you, Fred. Well done. Very well done. And tonight we have Robert giving out the chips. Come around back.
Hello, my name is Robert, and I am an alcoholic. It's a good story, Fred. It's good to see you. It's probably negotiable. It's color-coded to mark your time, not necessarily your progress in the program. We have a white chip, surrender chip, 24-hour chip. If anybody wants to try out a new way of life. Anybody else? White chip? We have a silver chip for 30 days. Anybody want to pick up a silver? We have a red chip, 90 days. No. Yellow for 6 months. Green for 9 months. Blue for years or multiples thereof. We always like to offer the white chip one more time. If you're embarrassed or bashful to come and get it now, pick it up after the meeting. Thank God for the chip you hold.
Thank you, Robert. Okay. We've got a brief moment or two to share AA-related announcements or NABA announcements.
Tickets in advance are $5. If you do it, $7. Not sure if you can come. We've got a lot of newcomers that would like to come that can't afford the ticket. You can make a donation to me or Tim, and we'll make sure a newcomer gets a free ticket September 10th. But hope everybody can come.
Yeah, that's a Saturday night. It's, the doors open at 9:30, right after the 12 and 12 meeting that meets in the back of this room here. And so we're going to have a disco, beach party, nonstop dancing upstairs and downstairs. Tinsley is going to be managing an open mic downstairs and contributing some of his Serenity songs, and it's going to be great. We're going to get a lot of talented people downstairs and a lot of talented dancers upstairs. And the dining room's the kitchen's going to be open, so there'll be plenty of good food, some of it healthy, some of it not. So for $5, it's a big bang for your buck, that's for sure. We also have the Thursday night men's meeting is having our 7th annual 50th anniversary barbecue, and that's Sunday, September 18th. And tickets are $7, and it's 12 to 2, and there will be a speaker meeting, and They go all out. Barbecue beef brisket, barbecue chicken, barbecue pork, shoulder. You know what's at a barbecue, but it's going to be a great event as well. Okay, y'all had enough? Or anybody else think of something? All right, then. I remind each of you that anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions. It reminds us to place principles before personalities. Any volunteers, we are grateful if you help us break down. And for those who will, please join us in the Lord's Prayer.
Let this circle represent what we can do together, what we can't do by ourselves. Let's have a moment of silence. Who always makes a great meeting?
Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread. And forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory, forever and ever. Amen. You shall come back to the first good work.
Before you go and tell your tale, you better.